The Spratly Islands, Tomas Etzler. We're pleased to have him here. We're going to see three separate short films that Tomas filmed. Before that, he's going to come and speak and give a little explanation of what he's done. By way of background, Tomas is a self-professed one-man band, a producer, cameraman, reporter. He hails originally from the Czech Republic. He's worked with CNN, he's worked with Czech TV, he's worked with Swiss television, I believe, as well, and as a freelancer. I think this project of filming in the Spratly Islands has become something of a passion to him to really show what's going on, and it's been very interesting to hear a few of his comments about how difficult it actually is to get there and how expensive it is to get there to film in an area which is really becoming very, very important in geopolitics. So it's my pleasure to introduce Tomas. He's going to speak to us a bit. Then we'll show the films and hopefully we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. And also please do enjoy your dessert while this all happens. My pleasure to introduce Tomas Etzler.
Thank you very much, Tara, for a very kind introduction, and thank you very much to the club for the hospitality and for the opportunity to be able to present these films. And thank you very much to you for coming. You know, when we planned this event, I had no idea, or I did not notice, that John Kerry will be visiting the region just a couple days prior to it. And if you noticed last week, Spratly Islands, Senkaku Islands, and other disputes in East Asia were all over the world press. So I think this is a perfect timing for this event to happen. As Tara said, you will be watching three videos from three trips I made between 2013 and 2014 to Scarborough Shoal, Senkaku Islands, or Diaoyu, how Chinese call it, and Spratly Islands. Why this? I think that this dispute is a huge topic. I think the potential for disaster in these disputes is extremely big. I'm native Czech, and I was very surprised, and my ears really peered up when last year when President Aquino, president of the Philippines, how he compared China to a Nazi Germany of 1930s. And he compared Spratly Islands to Sudetenlands. That basically China is just trying to see how far it can get with acquisition or with territorial claims before it's going to be stopped or before there is a real armed conflict. I also think that this huge topic is seriously underreported in world media. Of course, one aspect is that we have horrible stories in Ukraine, very horrible stories in imploding Middle East. So the attention of world media and of the world is mostly at those places. But I believe that territorial disputes in East Asia has a very dangerous potential to escalate out of control. One of the reasons. There are a couple more reasons why it's underreported. I said, Tara already mentioned it, it's very difficult to get to these areas. They are very remote. It takes days on boats to get to some of these places. That makes it extremely expensive. These three trips were some of the most expensive trips I've done in this region, and for many news organizations, this is simply cost forbidding. And there is also, whenever you go to this area, you have to negotiate with some of the security agencies or authorities of that country. You know, like for example, Senkaku, we had to cooperate with Japanese Coast Guard. I had to meet with officials from the Foreign Ministry. Spratly Islands, I was involved with the Philippine Navy, Philippine Marines, Philippine Coast Guard. So it's extremely logistically demanding. That's yet another reason for why is it so difficult. I'm also interested in these topics because I lived in Beijing for 7 years, and I am really interested in, you know, like, of course, China and anything Chinese, including Chinese foreign policy, which I simply have to tell you, I don't understand it. I think that whatever China is doing in South China Sea or East China Sea is, to me, sometimes almost irrational. because they are international bodies, they are international organizations, they are international systems that can resolve these issues, that can decide what is happening. And I really think that it is very counterproductive. I think, you know, I always put as an example of Chinese foreign policy Typhoon Hainan, which happened in the Philippines late 2013. It happened on Chinese doorstep. And yes, China has a dispute with the Philippines, but the reaction of China was just mind-blowing. The first thing they did, they announced international Chinese help to the Philippines in the amount of $100,000. IKEA gave $3 million themselves. China then corrected it later, they gave more money. But what I found even more mind-blowing is that China allowed U.S. military to move in. In Tacloban, U.S. military run the Tacloban land district. They sent in an aircraft carrier. It was a demonstration of American military power in the Philippines on the Chinese doorstep. I think China utterly failed to show that it's an Asian or even global leader. And I simply don't understand who is making this, I think, catastrophic decisions for China in Beijing. Anyway, three videos. The first video I show you is from my first trip. It was a trip to Scarborough Shoal. Just to remind you, Scarborough Shoal is a small shoal some 200 kilometers east from Luzon Island. There is believed that there are huge deposits of oil and natural gas in the surrounding bottom of the surrounding oceans. How the situation escalated there? In 2012, Philippine Coast Guard arrested or captured a Chinese boat of poachers. They were poaching corals, they were poaching giant clams, they were poaching other endangered species. Chinese Coast Guard rushed to help them, to the Chinese, and it ensued into almost a year-long standoff between Philippines and Chinese boats. There were like 200 or 300 Chinese boats, couple dozen Philippine boats. Then finally the truce was kind of negotiated with the involvement of the United States, and the agreement was that both countries withdraw from Scarborough Shoal. Philippines did, China didn't. China stayed in Scarborough Shoal and it's maintaining its physical presence at Scarborough Shoal since 2013. So that was the first trip. I was traveling on Banca, as you will see. The reason why I was traveling on Banca is two reasons. First of all, it's much cheaper than yacht. Plus, it's much harder to detect than yacht. Al Jazeera English was there a couple weeks before me or a couple months before me, and they were traveling on yacht, and they were detected by the Chinese from far away. They didn't even get anywhere near the shoal. We managed to get all the way to the shoal. Then the Chinese chased us away anyway, as you will see. Anyway, so I will try to, if I can work this up, I will try to play the first video from Scarborough Shoal.
Journey to the Scarborough Shoal from the fishing town of Masinloc in West Luzon starts at 10 at night. It should last around 18 hours.
I'm sorry, there is a sound problem. We tested it before. There was no problem before that working on it.
And loaded the boat with 16 gallons of drinking
water.
We are traveling on a banca, a traditional wooden fishing boat. There are six of us, four fishermen, CNN producer Nike, and me. There is no space for anybody else. Just waves and wind. That's the challenge, says the captain. A journey to the Scarborough Shoal from a fishing town of Masinloc in West Luzon starts at 10 at night. It should last around 18 hours, say the fisherman. Before the departure, we bought instant noodles, chocolate bars, and loaded the boat with 16 gallons of drinking water. We are traveling on a banca, a traditional wooden fishing boat. There are six of us, four fishermen, CNN producer Nike, and me. There is no space for anybody else. Just waves and wind. That's the challenge, says the captain. If my instincts dictate that I won't make it, I turn back. Masinloc, a town of some 40,000 people, is among the most affected by the dispute. The Scarborough Shoal is 125 miles west from here, within what the Philippines declares as its exclusive economic zone. That's little comfort to the fishermen here. Most of them have lost their jobs. Chinese maritime surveillance ships control the area and do not allow Philippine fishermen to fish there. 52-year-old Efren Forones has 6 children and has been fishing here for over 2 decades. A year ago, he managed to catch 3.5 tons of fish during one trip. Nowadays, he comes back with just 400 kilos, if. We used to buy 15 to 20 kilos of rice a month. Now we can only afford to buy 1 or 2 kilos, a friend says. I was planning to send one of my children to the college. I can no longer do it now. That means that the 2 currently in high school will just finish with high school. Our first sunrise on the boat. The land is nowhere in sight. The sea is 11,000 feet deep here. This banca is 29 feet long, 4 feet wide, and at the open sea it seems completely lost and powerless to someone like me who grew up in a landlocked country. Some of the busiest shipping lanes in Asia cross the waters of the South China Sea. Most of the vital natural resources and energy for South Korea, Japan and China travel through here. The goods produced in these countries travel to the Americas, Australia, South Asia, Europe and the Middle East. After 13 hours at sea, we receive a message from the Philippine Coast Guard that there are 3 Chinese vessels in the vicinity of the shoal. But we are still some 19 miles away.
It's been 16 hours since we left the shore and we are finally at our destination. Scarborough Shoal is some 450 feet behind us. And despite warnings from Philippine Coast Guards, we haven't met any Chinese boats yet.
The shoal is made of sandbars and few rocks, creating 58 square miles of green water lagoon. The waters here are rich fishing grounds, and the lagoon provides fishermen on small boats a shelter during storms. Geological research suggests that the bed of the ocean is rich in natural resources. Soon, the fishermen spot 2 quickly approaching ships. They claim to recognize the vessels as Chinese and insist that we leave immediately. I now have a phobia going to Scarborough. Efren explains. When I took some members of the media with us last time, if it would not be for the rubber boats from the Coast Guard, an accident would have surely had happened. I was sandwiched between 2 Chinese ships. The 3rd was at the boat's tail. I was trapped and did not know where to go. That's why I'm scared to go there, knowing the Chinese ships are there, because they can really get aggressive. We turn for home. The ships on the horizon slow down and let us leave. Later, the fishermen vent their frustration. Of course I am mad, this one says. It angers me so much because it is ours. Why are we banned from there? Their land is a place far from here. As we head for Masinloc, the sea conditions begin to worsen. Strong winds create a swell, the waves often more than 6 feet. To film on a constantly swaying boat is hard even on quiet seas. Now it's becoming almost impossible. And it is hard to keep the camera dry. Even a few drops of seawater could damage or destroy the camera. 2 hours from the shoal, we are losing our rudder. The boat has become uncontrollable. Efren blames the waves and struggles underwater to fix the rudder. After more than 20 years at sea, he has enough experience to deal with most emergencies. But 30 minutes after his repairs, the rudder broke off completely. The fishermen have to use a long, thick rope, which they drag behind the vessel, changing its position to steer the banca. The rudderless boat is much slower, and it's obvious that the return journey won't be 16 hours. In fact, the journey back took 21 hours. The fishermen's wives are relieved to see them, but want them to give up this dangerous livelihood and leave town. Many have already done so. Who would not get worried when they are out there, she asks. What if they would get shot? Another fishing community affected is the town of Subic, once home to one of the biggest U.S. naval bases outside the United States. The Americans left in 1991. The fishing market on the outskirts of town opens up early. The fishermen bring in their catch from 1 in the morning. The fish is sorted and weighed. The seafood traders distribute the fish not only to local restaurants and hotels, but also send it to capital Manila, about 100 miles away. The locals claim that the business is down 50% since the Chinese began patrolling the Scarborough Shoal. Once you approach Scarborough, they kick you away, he says. If you go near the ropes, because there are ropes that serve as their boundary, they will ask you to turn back and move away. The international litigation over shoal could take years. Local fishermen can't wait that long. While governments squabble over the South China Sea, many of them will likely be forced to give up the only life they have ever known and start from scratch somewhere else. Tomáš Etzler for CNN in Masinloc, the Philippines. A journey to the Scarborough Shoal from a fishing town of Masinloc in West Luzon starts at 10 at night. It should last around 18 hours, say the fisherman. Before the departure, we bought instant noodles.
I'm sorry, I'm a Mac guy, so this is a PC. I'm a
little bit. You need to pay the second one now, or
assume you were the second one. So I was just. You know, it was interesting, you know, to see that sentiment there, because everybody I talked to has been in that area was regretting that the United States left, because they believe that if they would stay in Subic, that China would never occupy Scarborough Shoal, because, by the way, they used it as a bombing target, you know, practice. So it's that sentiment in those villages, you know, which lost all this the livelihood, you know, it's extremely anti-Chinese. And yet another thing, you know, like, I think that that policy is not working. It's you don't win, or you are not. I don't think you have a clever foreign policy if you create enemies of your neighbors. Anyway, let's go to Senkaku. When I moved to China in 2006, Senkaku wasn't even an issue. I never heard about Senkaku or Jiaoyu, as the Chinese call it. And it only became an issue around 2008, 2009, where there were some surveys there that there are a lot of deposits there of oil, gas, natural gas, and perhaps also rare earths. And then the Chinese became very aggressively claiming these islands. It was also interesting, I covered in 2012 huge anti-Chinese protests, anti-Japanese protests in China. And it was very obvious to me that it was all organized by the government, because I witnessed, they were actually, the Chinese police was busing those protesters in front of the Chinese embassy in Beijing and Japanese embassy and Japanese consulate in Shanghai. I saw them bringing them lunch to those protesters. It was police distributing lunches, and they were distributing water bottles, which then the protesters were throwing at the embassies. Then they clamped on it, because there were more and more people among the Chinese demonstrators who were carrying portraits of Chairman Mao, who were criticizing the then President Hu Jintao that he is soft on Japan. And I think this is that kind of a game with fire that Chinese government has to watch very closely, because they don't want to antagonize the nationalists. They don't want to be seen as too weak on Japan or the Philippines, on the nationalists. They are, I think, working very, very thin line there. And of course, so I decided I will go to Senkaku to see what the situation there is, because I think Philippines cannot do anything. I mean, Philippines, as you see, their army is dilapidated, you know. Philippines were really dealing last 40 years mostly with domestic insurgencies. They were depending on external defense on the United States. The Japan is a different story. Japan has a very potent defense forces. So I think if the clash would happen between China and Japan, it would be much more violent and much more bigger consequences than between China and Philippines. Plus, look at the players. I mean, you've got biggest and second biggest economies in Asia. Plus, you've got the United States involved, who has a defense treaty with Japan. So, of course, I was very interested to look what the situation is like there.
According to the locals, the seafood restaurant Payao on Ishigaki Island is the best in town. But you won't find it in any tourist guide. Payao is run by local fishermen and serves as their hangout. It is the best place to find out what's going on in local fishing community. For months, the main topic at the bar here is a territorial dispute between Japan and China over Senkaku Islands, some 170 kilometers from here. China has never said anything about the islands until now. As soon as they found out there are some resources, they started to claim. That's ridiculous, says this octopus hunter. They should solve the problem peacefully. Because of the Second World War, the islands really know what the war really is. I am worried that the territorial problem escalates, says this fisherman. Just a few years ago, these men could fish in fertile waters around Senkaku as they pleased. Since China sends its ships to patrol around the archipelago, the fishing became almost impossible. Any ship daring to travel to Senkaku today must report to the Japanese Coast Guard. It offers protection to fishermen, but also prevents Japanese nationalists from traveling to the islands. Our crew also went through a thorough search. The guards are looking for Japanese flags or nationalistic banners. The commander tells us to stay away at least 2 nautical miles from the islands. He warns that if we break this order, he will personally arrest us on our return. Our boat launched shortly after 9 p.m. The captain of the modern 9-ton Zenko Maru, 53-year-old Zen Shonaka, promises a quiet 10-hour journey. We are escorted by one ship of the Japanese Coast Guard. Only recently, after Chinese ships started to appear, the Japanese Coast Guard started to come with us, the captain says. Since the 15th century, the uninhabited Senkaku Islands were a part of the Ryukyu Kingdom, a small independent kingdom squeezed between Japan and China. In 1879, it was annexed by Japan and turned into its Okinawa Prefecture. Tokyo lost control over the islands only between 1945 and 1972, when the archipelago was under the American administration. Chinese interest in the islands, which Beijing calls Tiaoyu, increased in 2008 after a geological survey of the ocean floor revealed potentially huge deposits of oil and natural gas. Beijing claims that it was China who discovered the islands in the 15th century and that a Japanese map from the 18th century describes them as Chinese. It demonstrates its claims by almost daily presence of the ships around the islands. China conducts normal naval activities in accordance with domestic and international laws. Freedom and safety in East and South China Seas has never been disturbed. The reality is that boats of both countries play a game of cat and mouse around the islands and try to push each other out. Chinese and Japanese military jets repeatedly faced off above the islands, and in one incident, a Chinese ship allegedly locked its rocket radars at Japanese targets. Asia started to look like Europe during the Cold War time. Asia needs to make something similar to NATO to keep the region peaceful. It would help this region, says this journalist who extensively reports on the issue. We are arriving to our destination at 5 in the morning, still in darkness. The sunrise reveals dramatic but beautiful silhouettes of the islands and 2 ships of the Japanese Coast Guard. The quiet morning changes dramatically around 8 a.m. There are ships popping up everywhere on the horizon.
The Japanese Coast Guard just warned us that on the east side of the islands there are several Chinese vessels and they ask us to leave immediately.
The Japanese Coast Guard warns our captain that the Chinese ships are trying to block our way back. He later describes the situation. When we were running between the islands, I saw the Chinese ships. Our coast guard told me to speed up, but I said we cannot go any faster. Then we were told to stop because it is too late. It was right between the islands, and I saw Chinese ships crossing right in front of us. One of them changed her direction as she saw us. The coast guard told me to move to the north side of Kitakojima Island so that we wouldn't be seen by the Chinese ships. Another Chinese ship came from the east, changing her course towards us. It was stopped by the Japanese coast guard. I was told to go to the east side of Minamikojima Island. Then I was told to go home, so I did. But one Chinese ship escaped from the Japanese blockade and began chasing us. The Japanese Coast Guard later informs us that at one moment the Chinese were only about 60 meters away from our fishing boat. The chase lasted for over 90 minutes, deep in what Japan claims to be its exclusive economic zone. During the height of the chase, we were protected by up to 4 Japanese ships. Such an aggressive chase of a fishing boat has been unprecedented. All major Japanese media inform about it the next day. It was clear that one wrong maneuver on either side could have led to an accident. It was also a clear demonstration of how high the tensions are and how quickly, and with no apparent reason, the situation at the archipelago can get out of control. accorded.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I don't think there would be a war between China and Japan. I really think that both countries need each other too much. However, they are very worried, you know, about like some trigger-happy, ambitious either soldier on either Japanese or Chinese side, which can lead to a very, very ugly skirmish. That it's funny. It was also funny when I was filming. We were doing a couple other stories around it. You know, it was also funny to see the attitudes in these countries towards the issue. In China, there is hatred. I mean, I think it, of course it goes back to the Second World War. But whenever we ask about this Senkaku issue or Diaoyu Islands issue, there was a lot of anger in China, a lot of hatred. In Japan, people were laughing. They were like, "Oh, Chinese, don't worry about them. You know, it's like it's ours. I mean, this is not even an issue." It's also interesting to see this high psychologist of this, and we talked to people in several cities, in both sides. It was interesting to see this dynamic. The last thing I want to show, it's a little bit longer. That's my trip to Spratly Islands. It's also an extremely fascinating issue because it has huge repercussions. China claims pretty much the entire South China Sea. There are another six claimant countries or regions for that for that region. And just to show you the impact of it, first of all, it completely, in a couple of years ago, it completely divided ASEAN. In Cambodia, I believe it was 2013, during the ASEAN summit, it was for the first time in ASEAN history when they did not have a final communique, a final statement, because ASEAN was divided with Laos and Cambodia, for example, being on the Chinese side. China is, of course, not part of ASEAN, but it's always at the meetings. And Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia on the other side. And I talked to Philippine Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they said ASEAN is dead. That was in 2013. This year was quite different. You know, on April 28th, ASEAN issued extremely strong extremely strong words denouncing Chinese reclamation of the islands in Spratly Islands. So maybe they are back united now against China. I don't know, but. It does affect more than just these involved countries. I filmed that last video in 2013. What changed since then was this extremely aggressive reclamation by China. When I was there in 2014, it was not really a big issue yet. Everybody knew that China is building something. But what they've done in last 13, 14 months is just really mind-blowing. They are building huge military bases. They are building landing strips there. And the Chinese military recently recognized that China will probably gain full military control of the South China Sea. That's why a couple of days ago, I don't know if you noticed it, they decided that they will start, it has to be approved, of course, by Obama, that they want to start more aggressive missions, more aggressive surveillance missions, air and naval missions in the area, which of course was immediately seriously attacked by China. So the tensions are there. But let's watch the film then, and we can maybe discuss it. We discuss it a little bit later.
Hour after hour, just sounds of the ocean and a fishing boat engine. Many tourists would spend a lot of money for these views, but you don't find any here. Only the bravest of fishermen venture into these waters.
No, that's a Coast Guard, that's a Chinese Coast Guard.
And this is Sierra Madre, a rusting, sun-scorched ship purposely grounded on the Ayungin Shoal, or Enaijiao, as the Chinese call it, part of the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. Here, 105 nautical miles or 194 kilometers west from the Philippine Palawan province, a handful of Philippine Marines protects the shoal from being taken over by China, whose ships are circling the coral lagoon like ravenous sharks. The standoff is at the center of one of the most serious territorial disputes in the world today. six countries claim various parts of the archipelago, with China claiming the entire South China Sea. The dispute has sucked in the United States and Japan. The result of this struggle will decide not only who will have the control of the islands and surrounding waters, but also over the entire West Pacific region. To get to the remote Spratlys is not easy. Negotiations with various Philippine government agencies, including the Ministry of Defense, to gain access took over a year.
The Sierra Madre, that's to us, is one of the most important vessels of the Philippine Navy for now. They're doing something that any other Philippine vessel cannot do, and that's to protect our national interest.
We left for the Spratlys at the end of April from Puerto Princesa, the capital of Palawan province. I am traveling with the government of the Calayan municipality. Calayan is a part of Spratlys and consists of six islets and four shoals. The final destination of the government is Pagasa Island, the only island in Calayan inhabited by a civilian population. On the way there, we are supposed to stop at two smaller islands to greet Philippine soldiers stationed there. Pagasa will be our staging point for the trip to Sierra Madre. The mayor of Calayan resides in Puerto Princesa and visits his constituents on Pagasa once a year. Lack of funds prevents him from traveling there more often.
This is life.
The purpose of this journey is some kind of a homecoming and reunion for my staff. I have staff in Pagasa and I have also staff or personnel here in Puerto Princesa.
Besides six members of the government, there are another 153 people on board, the boat crew, along with mostly inhabitants of Pagasa, returning to the isolated island after a few weeks of visiting their families in Palawan. The ship also carries food supplies, construction materials, and some animals, mainly poultry and pigs.
We were originally scheduled to leave at 4 in the afternoon and now it's 8:30 p.m. But it doesn't really matter. A journey to our first destination, Parola Island, will last approximately 50 hours, if everything goes smoothly.
The conditions at the sea were ideal and the first night of our trip went without problems. In the morning we were greeted by a beautiful sunrise. We are heading south. Puerto Princesa is located on east shores of the island province of Palawan. The Spratlys lie west from Palawan, so we have to sail around the entire island. The journey of the Queen Seagull, the boat we are sailing on, will end in Pagasa. In order to get to Sierra Madre in Ayungin Shoal from there, I have to hire another private vessel, which joins us near town of Rio Tuba.
We believe that using a smaller and faster fishing boat like this one would give us better chances to go through Chinese ships patrolling around Ayungin Shoal, the main destination of our journey to Spratly Islands.
We travel at speed of 9 knots. The aging vessel has two engines, which are serviced 24 hours a day by four mechanics. They have perhaps the hardest job on the boat. The temperature in the engine room on a lower deck exceeds 60 degrees centigrade or 140 Fahrenheit. My salary is only $230 a month, says the chief mechanic. The position next to me is $140. The rest receives around $120. The job is hard, but we have to accept it, because we need it. The passengers are sailing for free, but they had to pay for food, which the boat crew prepares for them three times a day in a little kitchen. One of the travelers is 28-year-old Jacqueline Morales, who is returning to Pagasa with her husband and three children. She is the teacher for some 50 children there. She looks at it as a service to her country. Not many teachers are willing to go to Pagasa. Life on the small island is good, she says, but the journey there is a misery for her. It is very difficult for me to travel with my kids, she says. Right now it's very dizzying, the travel. It's also scary. We don't know what will happen. I am with my kids. The situation here in the vessel is very difficult. The mayor is also worried. Calayan has only a little over 300 constituents, but the mayor feels almost parental responsibilities for them. The journey on a 28-meter-long vessel takes 3 days in the open seas.
Sometimes when I'm alone, I'm just thinking really deeply about this situation. It really touches me how difficult it is to handle. So, although it's a small constituent, but the risk is really great.
crew has been traveling to Spratly Islands for 16 years. In the past, it was the weather which posed the biggest challenges. The region is hit by frequent and strong typhoons. But increasing territorial tensions has led to growing numbers of confrontations, especially with the Chinese Coast Guard ships. The captain recalls how even this boat has been harassed during two past years. Sometimes I am scared because I am carrying a lot of passengers, he says, especially at night, because I don't know when it's midnight and if they block me, I won't be able to confirm who they are. That's what I'm scared of, because I don't know them. Then suddenly they would block my path. I would call them on the radio, but they wouldn't answer. That's dangerous. But our journey is smooth and uneventful. The biggest challenge for the passengers is boredom. Only schools of dolphins provide the occasional entertainment. It turns out that our first stop after 2 days of sailing is actually Lavak Island. A small heap of sand measuring only 8 hectares is known as a sanctuary for birds and sea turtles. A small unit of Philippine Marines is stationed here in modest accommodations. Water and food supplies must be brought to them by ships of the Philippine Navy. The tiny island has an extraordinarily strategic location. It is the closest land to the so-called Reed Bank, a large underwater volcanic table mound believed to contain huge deposits of oil and natural gas. From Lavak we continue another 12 hours to Parola Island, slightly larger than Lavak and also with a small detachment of Marines. Our arrival coincided with the annual inspection by the Philippine Navy. They have brought a priest who presided over a Catholic mass. A welcome distraction for the soldiers who otherwise live here in absolute isolation.
With this place, which is very far from the civilization, they only draw strength from God. So religion is a very important role in their life.
It is hard to imagine that a handful of modestly armed Marines could defend the island against an invasion. But a hostile capture of Parola by another country would be seen as an act of aggression. It would be condemned by the international community and escalate the tensions in the South China Sea. The soldiers here serve more as human shields than a credible defense force. Back on the boat, our final destination is not far over the horizon, less than 4 hours sailing. After 68 hours at sea, we are finally here. Pagasa does not have a port, and it is impossible for our boat to get to the shore. People and supplies must be transferred onto smaller boats, which take them closer. It is a chaotic scene, but everybody gets off safely. It is a low tide, and the last few hundred meters of the shallow sea must be crossed by foot. Pagasa Island has an area of some 37 hectares, and about 120 civilians live here permanently. During summer months, the population swells up to 300. The community has its own school and a small medical facility with 5 beds. There are no doctors. The center is run by trained nurses. And there is a municipality building housing the Kalayaan government. Until recently, Pagasa served only as a military base. Small units of the Philippine Navy and Air Force are stationed here. The island has its own drinking water, but all other supplies must be brought in, either by boat or plane. A dilapidated landing strip on the island can accommodate C-130 Hercules and smaller aircraft. It is run by Philippine Air Force. The morning after our arrival was disrupted by a few automatic rifle shots. Local units were holding a small military drill. The annual inspection by the Philippine Navy had by now arrived here and was checking the defensive preparedness of the soldiers stationed on Pagasa.
I am very much happy because I observed that the troops are in high morale, in high state of morale. To maintain the morale, we often conducted the spiritual activities like having a Sunday mass, and we have also the friendship games activities with the local people.
None of the officers are willing to say on camera against whom their soldiers are supposed to be defending the island. off camera they admit that they are worried about the increased activities of Chinese naval vessels in the surrounding seas. The Chinese call the island Zhongyedao and claim it belongs to them.
China is getting stronger economically and at the same time militarily. So I think that they can do it. I think they are trying to do it. They are trying to flex their muscles here in the region. And of course, they said that their economic development, they're trying to coin it as a peaceful rise or peaceful development. But when we look at their behavior in the region with their aggressiveness, that puts their policy of peaceful rise in doubt and in question.
The Chinese government declined to comment on this story. It is 6 in the morning. Pagasa youth are gathered in front of the municipality building for morning exercise. It is one of the initiatives of Kalayaan government to promote a healthy lifestyle on the island. For an outsider, watching an exercise to the rhythm of techno beats on a small island in the middle of South China Sea, it is a surreal show. The government provides housing and basic food for free to Pagasa inhabitants. People live modestly in houses made from wood and bamboo. Many people on the main Philippine islands live in far poorer conditions. The Morales family is slowly settling down. They are satisfied with the life here, but admit that the territorial dispute with China makes them worried. What scares me the most, of course, he says, is that there might be a war like in the old times, when one country was bombed by another because of territories. It is also scary because my family is here. That's why I get more scared that something is going to happen. Mayor Bito Onon is an optimist. He hopes that both China and the Philippines will solve the dispute according to international law and that the island will remain under Philippine control. He has a great vision for Pagasa. He dreams about turning it into a popular tourist destination that could compete with the Maldives or islands in the Caribbean. Bito Onon believes that all this could be achieved within 10 years.
I hope you can see we have a marina, a sheltered harbor, a dredged one, where all the yachts, the fishing boats would park securely. And in front of the marina, you can see it's a wharf. But behind that are commercial establishments. There's, lodging houses, restaurants, and a fuel depot, water depot, and things that you want to buy.
After 2 days on Pagasa, we are finally heading on a chartered boat to Sierra Madre at Ayungin Shoal. Before we left, we had a meeting with a captain and a navigator, discussing what to do if confronted by Chinese ships, which is a common occurrence there. We agreed that unless the captain feels that his boat is in danger, we should try to outmaneuver the Chinese and push through. We were lucky. Most of the boats approached the shoal from Palawan, from the southeast. We were arriving from Pagasa, from the northwest, and caught the Chinese ships by surprise. Although they spotted us and were closing in at full speed, we had a head start and entered the lagoon in waters too shallow for the big Chinese ships before they could block us. The Sierra Madre, sitting in turquoise water of the shoal, is a surreal scene. It looks like a post-apocalyptic Hollywood movie set. Only the dramatic music is missing. It is hard to believe that people live here. The Philippine Marines are helping us to moor our boat along the hull of Sierra Madre. We get on board using wobbly makeshift ladders. The Chinese ships, which tried to block us a few moments ago, are now quietly observing us just from several hundred meters away. The Sierra Madre was built by the United States in 1944 to serve in the Pacific as a transport ship during World War II. After the war, it changed hands twice. First, it was transferred to the South Vietnamese Navy during the Vietnam War, then to the Philippines after the fall of Saigon. In 1999, the Philippines purposely grounded the Sierra Madre on the Ayungin Shoal. The Secretary of Defense at the time, Orlando Sanchez Mercado, claims it was in reaction to China's decision in 1994 to take control of Mischief Reef, just 13 nautical miles northwest from Ayungin.
We were forced, and we had no recourse, but to look for means by which we can retain our presence. And during our watch, we decided that the best way to do that was to beach this particular LSTs, landing ship tanks, and keep our troops there. And they have been there for all this time.
The soldiers live here in extreme conditions. They face a merciless sun and soaring temperatures or frequent typhoons. The ship is infested by hundreds of rats and millions of cockroaches. They live in absolute isolation, cut off from life at home, the Philippines, and the rest of the world. Our life is hard sometimes, this sergeant says, because we are far from our families. We can't communicate with them, and we are in the middle of the ocean. That's our everyday life here. We can't do anything. They often have to struggle for bare survival. 2 years ago, the Chinese started to block Philippine Navy ships, bringing in supplies, including drinking water. Today, the Marines depend on civilian fishing vessels, which managed to squeeze past the ship blockading the shoal, just as we have done, to bring provisions. When that doesn't work, the Navy uses airdrops. During our stay on Sierra Madre, a small plane dropped two loads. The first landed on the boat, the second in the water. The boxes contain towels and flip-flops, basic food supplies, drinking water and soft drinks. What cheered the Marines most were boxes from a fast food chain filled with fried chicken, rice and French fries.
Good to go, this is a wings of the chicken. I'm going to eat the fried chicken.
Okay. There were also letters of support and admiration from Philippine school children, which moved some of the men to tears. There is not much to do on the ship. The Marines watch Chinese vessels and report their movements to their superiors at a military base back in Palawan twice a day.
China Basil, yung pangalan ng China Basil.
In the remaining time, they clean weapons or exercise with improvised tools made from the metal parts of the disintegrating ship.
It is quite difficult and even dangerous to even walk here. I have no idea how strong the metal surface of the ship still is. It looks like thin ice, very weak, and I certainly do not want to end up on the floor of the bottom deck, which is some 6 meters or 18 feet below me.
The young men here are used to hardship. They all come from very poor families, and becoming soldiers helped them to escape utter poverty. Before this deployment, most of them served in Philippine jungles fighting Islamic extremists. The main part of their menu is fish. It is essential to the Marines' survival on Sierra Madre. That's why one of the most important activities on Sierra Madre is fishing. The Marines fish twice a day. They move around the shoal in small boats and makeshift rafts. The waters of the lagoon are full of marine life, and water is as shallow as 1.5 meters or 5 feet at some places. The Marines are fishing with improvised fishing rods and spear guns. Everything is improvised here. They use strips of wood with rubber straps as flippers to propel themselves around the water. The catch is then grilled or dried on the deck of the ship. Fishing also helps to kill the time and maintain morale on the wreck. Morale is high according to the unit's commander. If the Chinese try to enter here, we will defend it, says the commander. We will use our training to defend the ship. We will lay down our lives to defend the ship. That may not be necessary.
It's obvious that it is only a matter of time before this boat falls apart and the Philippine Marines have to leave. That will be the time for China to move in.
Ayungin is usually surrounded by two Chinese vessels, but during our first day here, three more Chinese ships arrived. Two belonged to the Coast Guard. The Marines have never seen the third one before. Using binoculars, I can see many Chinese sailors taking pictures of us using cameras with long lenses.
It's 5 p.m, and we are surrounded by five Chinese vessels. Even the Marines are saying they have never seen anything like that before. I'm getting a little bit worried about how do we get out of here tomorrow with our film material.
We left Sierra Madre at dawn. After saying quick goodbyes to the soldiers, we are off to sea. To our disbelief and surprise, the Chinese ships did not even move and let us go in peace. Sierra Madre is slowly shrinking on a horizon, a rusty shell of a ship caught in the center of a geopolitical chess game. It may look like a stalemate, but it is not. It seems that the game has already been decided.
Thank you very much. It was really one of the most bizarre trips of my life. I could not believe what I'm seeing on that ship. I originally wanted to sleep with the Marines, and after dusk, there were rats and cockroaches crawling out of everywhere. It was really like in a horror movie, and I decided to go back to our fishing boat. I chickened out. One of the reasons I went to Ayungin also is because, of course, I wanted to see that ship. Before me, there was only one foreign crew there. It was the New York Times four months earlier. They described it as a futuristic, absurd fishing camp. And the reason for that is because I'm sure you know it, that now the Philippines took China to international court, and Ayungin is one of their examples. It's only around 100 nautical miles from Philippine coast. That makes it well within exclusive economic zone in the Philippines, and the ruling by the international court, which China completely ignores, they didn't even send a representative, they said there is nothing to discuss, it's ours. The ruling is coming up within a couple months. The problem is that no matter what the ruling is, if it goes against China, there is nothing what can enforce it. I talked to the foreign ministry at the Philippines about it, and they said they at least hope that it will show that China is breaking international laws and that it will move public opinion around the world against China. I tried, of course, for all these stories, I tried to access Chinese authorities. Of course, we also tried Chinese military, because CCTV, Chinese central television, occasionally gets embedded with Chinese military, but forget it, as a foreigner. We were simply not allowed. Most of our requests for interviews with government Chinese officials were unanswered. There is one more disputed area I wanted to cover, and it's Paracels Islands, which is mostly claimed by China, of course, and by Vietnam. Vietnamese military occasionally brings foreign journalists there. I wasn't invited yet. China does tourist cruises there. So I thought at least I can board on a tourist cruise. But they're only for Chinese. No foreign passports are allowed on these cruises. Al Jazeera producer in China, he is a Chinese national, he managed to buy tickets on that cruise, but somehow they figured out that he's a journalist, and he was banned too. So there is no possible way to say that. And the fact that it's only for the Chinese, it tells to me it's not a tourist cruise, it's a propaganda trip. They want to show this is our territory. Why wouldn't take foreign tourists there? That doesn't make any sense. So I tried to cover it as much as I could from the Chinese side, but it's simply impossible. They don't communicate about this issue at all. But that's all. I will open the floor to the questions if you have any. One thing I learned on all these trips, I don't suffer from seasickness. I had a camera crew on the second trip on Senkaku Islands. And you saw it, the sea was extremely violent. And I had a Japanese translator and a cameraman, a Czech cameraman, and it wasn't just about they were sick to their stomach. I've never seen anything like that. They were just lying there like paralyzed. They were like after some horrible insect bit them. They could not even move. I've never seen anything like that before. So I filmed that on that boat, so I'm not seasick. But it's not for the people, you know, those seas, especially Scarborough and St. Kaku, were quite violent. Anyway, the floor is yours now if you want to ask any questions.
Thank you very much, Thomas. I would just say what I admire about watching those documentaries is, you know, they show the hallmark of any good journalism, which is a real determination to get there and tell the story. And, you know, I don't envy you spending months and months, you know, jumping through hoops to get the permissions and then, you know, sharing sleeping quarters with rats and cockroaches. So, bravo. We'll open it up to a few questions from the floor. We do have a microphone somewhere. Yeah. So if you just wait for the microphone, please, and fire away. Thank you.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. Do you think something could happen like the Chinese fighter that collided with the American surveillance plane that could spark something much bigger?
I think that's very possible. I mean, accidents happen, and it happened before in other instances in other countries. It might happen again. It might happen between United States and China. It might happen between China and Japan. There were Japanese and Chinese military jets facing off. They are facing off frequently. Every month there is some sort of scramble. So I think it's a matter of time. It's not a matter of when. It's a matter of if. It's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when. It's a matter of time. I think it might happen. Of course, both sides would be very careful not to happen. But accidents happen. I mean, that's something unavoidable.
Or it's generated by some maverick who just decides, I'm going to go.
That's another fear which some of the military people I talk of, camera, they are worried about it. That might be somebody very ambitious, very eager to kind of please their superiors and will do something like that. There was an incident. It was actually between the Philippines and Taiwan. I don't know if you remember, and Philippine Coast Guard actually shot and killed couple Taiwanese fishermen like 2 or 3 years ago. Because Taiwan is, the countries involved are of course China, Philippines, Vietnam, Taiwan, Brunei, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and there are skirmishes there all the time. You know, between Taiwan and Philippines, between Philippines and China. So. There were already a couple of people were killed. China sunk Vietnamese boats. They were claiming that they were too aggressive, but then they were proven wrong because somebody fortunately filmed it and showed that the Chinese Coast Guard ship, you know, metal Coast Guard ship, rammed from behind the Vietnamese wooden fishing boat, much smaller. So yes, the tension is there.
Thank you. Florence?
Thank you. Florence Changy from Le Monde. First, can you give us an overview of the three places you visited? Because the issues are slightly different in Daewoo, Seoul, and Spratly, just to understand how you view them as their own identity.
You mean the Senkaku, Scarborough, and Spratly?
Yeah, because each of them have got a different. And then more specifically, or maybe I'll ask the question about the Spratly after, about the building of things there, which we haven't seen.
Honestly, I don't think they are that different. I think that what China is doing is China. I think for China, main reason they are doing it is quest for resources. China is very resource-hungry country, and Africa is too far. This is right there. So I think that's one of the main reasons China is doing it. I think they are also doing it for their domestic audiences. They want to see they are strong. They will not let another big powers and other countries dictate to them what to do, as they did for centuries before. So they want to show that to their public, domestic public. But I think those issues are very similar. They are territorial issues which are based, of course, on the territorial ownership, but also on the potential resource richness of those areas. There are differences, you know, with who the players are. You know, like you have two biggest economies in Asia when it comes to Senkaku facing each other, and then you have small developing economies of Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines facing China. I really think they are not as different. Of course, Senkaku is a very small area. Scarborough Shoal is a very small, isolated area. Spratly Islands is 700,000 square kilometers. It's a huge area. Maybe this is a little bit different because it's such a scale. Plus, I was filming on Navak. From that island, you can see there is a another island 4 kilometers away, and there is a Vietnamese military base there. It's all right there. Spratly Islands are more of a powder keg because there is quite a few countries involved there.
And I wanted to ask you about the Spratly Islands precisely. We've seen pictures just a few days ago of this massive building and reclamation work going on by the Chinese. When you were there just, what, a year ago? Or how long?
Yes,
ago
a year ago.
Did you have clues about this coming?
No, it wasn't such a big issue last year. As I said, the world knew already that Chinese are building something there. But you look at their satellite images available online, it was really nothing compared to what it is now. Chinese really pushed very, very hard last year to escalate and to accelerate this reclamation. I think what China is doing, they are taking advantage of the turmoil in the Middle East and in Ukraine, because the whole world is watching there mostly. They don't really pay attention to East Asia. And we could not go anywhere close to it. Although I've got footage of it, which I didn't include in the documentary. From Pagasa Island on one side, I've heard this incredible noise, and on the horizon I spotted literally dozens of ships, and I asked the mayor what it is, and he says, this is the Chinese digging the coral. And I was like, why are they digging the coral? He said, I don't know. and they said, they are after the giant clam, and they are nobody can stop them. Philippines doesn't have any, as a laughable navy, very old navy. Coast Guard is also very limited. So nobody can stop the Chinese. So big problem about it is also, I wonder, you know, why this United Nations is doing anything, because what it is not only they are reclaiming islands in the territories which are disputed, you know, maybe it is belong to China. Let's wait for the international court to decide it. But it's a systematic destruction of the whole marine system. I mean, they are destroying those corals. Once the corals are gone, the fish is gone, so they are creating a huge dead zone in that ocean. You know, somebody I think finally picked up on it last week. It is a tremendous ecological disaster. They are destroying the environment of South China Sea by those reclamations.
Michael Beer, no affiliation. With the creation of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the new maritime Silk Road, doesn't China effectively just pacify all of these ASEAN participants? And I mean, by promising railroad investments and new ports and all of the infrastructure investment, to the point where effectively these ASEAN governments will have no other recourse other than to accept the money.
That's very possible. I cannot predict this, but this is very possible. Depends, you know, how China will work with Vietnam, because I've heard that they're also maybe thinking about building a railroad through Vietnam. Cambodia, Laos has been always allies of China, you know, no matter what, you know, and some of the railroads are supposed to go there. They are offending India by that. By Pakistan, because India now feels that they will be surrounded, and there will be no railroad to the Philippines. I think, but you know, also I tell you what: when I was in Cambodia, or when I was in Burma, people there are really they are getting angry. They said we have become another province of China. All the resources go to China. All the money from China goes to our leaders. You know, nothing is, you know, Chinese, when they build a factory, they bring their own workers. They bring even their own cleaners of their dormitories. So people, I think it's very counterproductive, because I think there is a growing anti-Chinese sentiment about population. You know, Indonesia is nervous. Malaysia is nervous because they are so close. What will they claim next? I simply don't think they are doing it very clever way. I mean, the countries were suggesting, okay, let's develop it together. Let's just get together and let's develop it, you know, together. And China doesn't want to hear anything. No, we are not developing anything together. It's ours. Maybe in the long term, if it brings some financial, some economic benefits to these other involved countries, maybe. But who knows when this is going to happen, and who knows if it is going to happen at all.
And Angus Forsyth has no affiliation. Do you know if the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, which basically outsiders believe sets national policy, is in control of this whole South China Sea 14 points or 9 points line issue, or is this being delegated to a sort of lower profile, such as the military, which runs this on its own?
No, I believe it is coming from the top. Because Chinese, you have to, I've been there for 7 years, I lived there for 7 years, you have to listen to Chinese lingua, to Chinese expressions, and they call this as a core interest. They call Tibet core interest, they call Taiwan core interest, and they refuse to negotiate, they refuse to compromise on their core interest. And some local official commander cannot do it. This is definitely coming straight from the top. The question is, you know, who are making this decision? So, you know, we were discussing it before, you know, there is nobody in the Chinese government today who would have international experience. All of them were educated in China. None of them had held any post in any international body, any international. So I think they are very inexperienced when it comes to foreign policies. But that put aside, I do believe it's come straight from the top, from the standing committee.
Yes. Yeah, Paul Schulte, University of Science and Technology. So I think there's 99 rigs that have already been created. So that's like $15 billion that they've already invested in oil rigs, never mind the airport. But the question I have is, you know, I was at a dinner several months ago, and one of the guys who was there was a retired admiral who was commander-in-chief of the Asia-Pacific in Honolulu. And, you know, somebody asked him, you know, the Philippines has invoked its mutual defense pact with the United States and has asked the United States to join against China. And he said, are you kidding me? You know, we were kicked out of Subic Bay. We were kicked out of Clark Air Force Base. And hey, you know what? Why don't you call us in about 10 years? You know, and so there's like a pretty much a to hell with you attitude in terms of really respecting any defense treaty with the Philippines when the U.S. was pretty much summarily expelled in a not-so-nice way. And so, you know, this is a really problematic issue. Do you agree, or?
I absolutely agree with you. Can you please repeat the first part of the questions? I missed that part about the investment.
99 rigs, oil rigs already.
Yes. No, I absolutely agree with you. And when President Obama was in the Philippines last year, I believe it was, they explicitly ask him if United States will come to defend Philippines if something happens. And he brilliantly completely avoided that question. He said, we will stand by our, you know, he was very esoteric, you know, like, we will stand by our allies, but he never explicitly said, as they did in the case of Japan. Hillary Clinton, when she was still a secretary, and I think maybe Kerry repeated it, they said they will, that Senkaku Islands fall under that defense treaty between United States and Japan, and they explicitly said they would come to Japanese defense. They didn't do that with Philippines. You are absolutely right. They are very lukewarm on that issue and avoiding, you know, direct questions on that issue. And I mean, if Philippines, I don't think China at this point would attack the Philippines. But if something would happen, there would be, of course, a lot of condemnation from the side of the United States, but I don't think any military action would be taken.
Monita Rajpal, no affiliation. What is actually being said or discussed in terms of how these territorial disputes will be solved? A lot is being said about international bodies having to come in and make those decisions, but what goes into making these decisions? What goes into actually deciding what belongs to who?
Well, there are two aspects how to do that. You know, like, first of all is the distance from the shore. 200 nautical miles is considered internationally exclusive economic zone. A lot of these islands, I mean, like 70% of these islands are within an exclusive economic zone of the Philippines or Vietnam or Malaysia. Another criteria is the continental shelf. If those islands are on the continental shelf of that country, like China, that China might have a very good case. But China is 1,100 kilometers from there. So this is not going to be a case. And whatever the ruling is, yes, so there are international rules, there are international bodies which can decide whose is what, but there are no ways to enforce it. You know, I asked the bitter onion, that beautifully naive mayor with this grand utopia vision, I asked him, do you really believe that if China is if the ruling is against China, that China will return these islands, that they will go back? He said, well, we have to believe in something. And I pushed him, I said, do you really believe that? And he said, no. And then I asked him, so what is the solution? He thought a little bit and he said, I guess we just have to wait until Chinese Communist Party implodes and starts laughing hysterically. You know, so that's the only solution I get to the problem, because once China puts their foot there, they will not leave. There is no way, if China builds those bases there, that they are going to move if somebody tells them to. Forget it. This is not going to happen.
If I may, a lot of what you're describing seems to stem, correct me if I'm wrong, but from an impression that all of this has arisen, especially, you know, in the Spratlys and the Scarborough Shoal area, because of an American security vacuum. The Americans have pulled out, whether willingly or not, and the Chinese have moved in. Do you think a return, a convincing return, a show of force by the Americans would do what's necessary from the Philippine point of view and those other claimants, or is it too late now?
I'm afraid it's too late. As I said, China will not back off. I mean, they will really not back off. I think that this was, I give you an example, and like, there is, of course, a lot of resentment against the U.S. forces in Japan, in Okinawa. But some people are happy because, as I said, you know, like, people in the Philippines believe if that base in Subic was, it was one of the biggest bases outside of the United States, if they wouldn't move, the Chinese would not come in. And now, already when I was living in, when I was still living in China, like 2011, 2012, there were articles published in Chinese newspapers, party newspapers, by scholars who were claiming that Okinawa belongs to China. And nothing in Chinese newspapers is published without the consent or agreement of the Communist Party. So they do have huge ambitions. And I don't believe that if United States would come back to the Philippines, China may stop at where they are, but they will never retreat. You know, they might stop. I don't know what is their next step. Well, I can tell you, you know, I was once in China when I was in Beijing. I was out for a dinner with friends. And there were a couple Japanese, and there was a friend of a friend there who was a retired Chinese military commander. And we were, of course, sooner or later, we start talking about Senkaku Jiayu Islands. And he said, don't worry about this. You know, China is in no rush. We have a long, long vision. One day, and he looked at the Japanese guests, one day the whole Japan will belong to China. But don't worry about this. This is not going to happen in our lifetime. You know, so I don't know. They seem to be expansionists, and just back to your question, no, I don't think they will retrieve. They might stop asserting new territories, asserting new shoals, new islands, but who knows? I don't know. They claim the whole thing is theirs. This nine-dash line, it's like 95% of the South China belongs to them. And they will not, this is their core claim, core value. They will not back up, and they will not compromise on that.
Thanks, Thomas. Any further questions? One more then.
Okay, Edith Terry, unaffiliated, I guess. On that particular point, Taiwan has been a core value. Reunification has been a core value essentially since 1949. But they have yet to go to war. They've come very close a couple of times, but it's still, you know, they play that long game. So I guess the question is there a long game here? It's one thing to harass fishermen. It's even one thing to have, you know, these little funny skirmishes in the sky. But it's another thing to risk war. So I just wonder what your view is on that.
And I absolutely agree with you. But that situation is evolving. is not that it's a kind of a not changing status quo. It is escalating. You know, as I said, when I moved to China in 2006, I've never heard of Senkaku. 2007, I've never heard of Senkaku. All of a sudden, the issue is here. 5 years ago, you never heard of reclamations in China, in the South China Sea. So they are pushing how far they can get. And no, I don't believe there will be a big open war now between China and Japan, or between China and the Philippines, or between China and Vietnam. There will be these skirmishes, but I really do not dare to predict what's going to happen in 10, 15 years with Chinese military, because Chinese military is not that strong yet. I mean, it's getting bigger and stronger every year, but it cannot even face, I think, the Japanese defense forces. But I cannot and will not even speculate what can happen in 15, 20 years. It's impossible. But at the moment, you are right. At the moment, I don't think there is a threat of a war.
I think we have time for one more question. Is anyone else on the floor? If not, I'll hand back to Florence to wrap. Yes, okay.
Sorry.
You did have one earlier, didn't you?
Do they actually need to go to war? They just keep nibbling away. They don't need a war, do they?
That's true. That's true. That's absolutely. You know, like the question is, what is next? They did not get Senkaku. I mean, the Ogiao Island. But it's basically what President Aquino said. They are just trying to see what they can get away with, and let's see where they will go next. I talked to some officials in Indonesia. Indonesia doesn't play it this way, but they are extremely worried about what kind of islands they will claim, because they are already, this Naidash line is very close to Indonesian. It even touches or goes into Indonesian exclusive zone. So Indonesia is, for example, worried. But let's see. I mean, like, the time will tell. But it is. They go slowly, slowly. They have time. They really have. They don't really. They are in no rush.
But have these dashed lines moved down the South China Sea over the years?
No. The first 9 dashed line was actually.
No, I don't mean the 9 dashed. There was a 5 dashed, wasn't there?
Yes. The funny thing is, you know, that the 9-dash line was for the first time introduced by Kuomintang in 1947. Then in 1948, the Chinese government said, no, the most southeast part, the most southern part of China is Hainan Island, you know, Island. Now they have this 9-dash line. And the thing is, I was talking to the Philippine foreign ministry, and I was like, how do you think did they come up with this line? He said, I don't know, maybe they spilled noodles over the map. They were laughing at it too. they said, you know, it's irrational, this 9-dash line. You know, it has absolutely no historical or geological or geographical reasoning for that.
We're just about out of time, but we'll squeeze one final question in from Florence.
Well, it sounds by the rain that we are stuck in for a while anyway, so I'd like to ask you, do you think it's possible that there is some kind of tacit agreement between China and the US? Because I find very strange that the US is suddenly coming up now that it's clearly too late, whereas they've seen this building. They've seen this in the process. It's obvious by satellite imaging and so on. And why now that there are so many, now that it's clearly too late, they suddenly screaming to the wall for whatever the expression is?
I mean, this is a question way above my experience. The thing is, you can speculate, of course, you know, like maybe they didn't really pay attention to it. Maybe really they're focused mostly on Ukraine or Middle East. And these changes that really happened, it wasn't over the years, it happened over the months. It happened really like, I don't remember what I was reading, like 4 to 6 months, it just wasn't there. It wasn't there before. There was some sort of construction happening, but all of a sudden there was an island, you know, within a couple of months. Plus, I don't believe in these conspiracies. And the thing is, if there will be a deal, the United States last week announced, and it has to be approved by Obama at first, that the United States announced that they will start more aggressively patrolling in the South China Sea. They want to let their military vessels to go as close as 12 nautical miles to what China claims to be theirs. They want to increase surveillance flights. China very angrily reacted to that nobody is allowed to on their territory and what have you. So I don't think there is such a deal.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, just finishing, the Americans are incredibly present. I was indeed in Tacloban on the first days of the typhoon, and it was so impressive to see how fast, how numerous, how powerful they were there. So there is no way they have not seen this coming. I mean, no, they're busy elsewhere, but they, I find it a bit.
I don't know, but it, you know, like nobody saw it coming. Like when I was talking to, and I still communicate with my friends or my producers in the Philippines. They are surprised how quickly that happened. They are surprised. They are like, are they kidding me? I mean, are they serious? You know, how is it possible that it's happening? But it's right there, 100 kilometers away from, or 100 nautical, or 150 kilometers away from Palawan province.
Thank you very much, Thomas. We are out of time, but thank you so much for a really stimulating and fascinating body of work, and for taking all our questions. The heavens have opened up, so you know you're familiar with the water, but hope you don't get too drenched on your way out tonight to Korea, I believe.
Yes.
Anyway, safe journey on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.